This is CliffCentral.com. That's all you
got. Oh yeah, there we go. That's Train with Play That Song. You like it, Sia? I knew it would be your kind of song.
If I ever had to release music,
it would sound like that.
Yes.
It would be just like that.
Happy. A mix between Happy Go Lucky and High School Musical.
Nothing wrong.
Somewhere there.
I bumped into a girl the other day who's trying to do like happy pop music stuff, and she said she's not sure that there's a market for it. I said, oh, don't you worry.
Meanwhile, you were really thinking?
No, I was really thinking.
Okay.
I think people want to feel happy. This is cheesy as hell.
Yeah, there's a fine line though.
It's cheesy as hell, but I promise you, in the morning, when you're feeling rough, you need songs like that. That's what I learned from radio all those years ago.
Did you just cough up dust? Is that how old you are?
Yeah, that's what I did. All righty. Let's find out about what's going on in the news. Mubs has got a couple of pointers for us. Let's pay careful attention and maybe, just maybe, we'll make sense of the day in all the different ways that we have to today. Mubs, over to you.
Beautiful.
Thank you. Is this a new one?
Yes.
Wow.
You don't sound grateful, my bud. Gareth spent his entire holiday.
I tried to learn how to play the trombone just for you.
Thank you so very much. It is the right start to 2018.
I thought I played that very well. Okay, let's get into it.
Okay, so hairs have been split by the CEO of University South Africa in a meeting that took place in Pretoria yesterday, where the CEO, Ahmed Bauer, says that South Africa will be offering a free-based, will be offering free-based education.
Hang on, who's this?
This is the CEO of Universities South Africa.
Is this?
USAF.
Oh, not UNIS.
No. Oh. Universities South Africa.
Okay.
So he says that South Africa will be offering free-based education, not free education in 2018. And in case you're confused about what that means, here's what he said.
Okay.
He explained that the practicalities around how free education would be implemented, following a meeting with the Department of Higher Education and Training yesterday, representatives from the country's 26 universities were all present at that meeting, which was held at the department's Pretoria offices. Bauer explains that each university will still set its own fees to be approved by the institution's council, which will then be paid by bursaries funded by the Department of Higher Education.
Oh my God.
That sounds like an excuse.
According to him, he says that unlike the previous NSFAS loans scheme, the department's bursaries will not be capped and will hence be differential to each university.
Are we going to just do bachelor degrees, or will people staying any degree be able to? Because then I'm going to go and do a doctorate. The only thing stopping me is fees.
Yesterday was the first set of what I suspect is going to be a longer round of meetings, and the department was not immediately available for further comments.
You better believe they would.
It sounds to me like there's still going to be plenty of times where they're going to have to go into those boardrooms to hash things out, to discuss. And this is where the headache lies, is that these guys are now the ones who have to find a solution to this decision that was taken, and they have to make it work because they don't have a choice.
You know, I hate to
It's tough for these guys, actually.
I hate to quote someone like Margaret Thatcher, but the problem with free anything is that you eventually run out of other people's money.
Smart.
That's the truth. And if there isn't money, and if you expect it just to be free, you don't realize that there are lecturers who need to be paid, there are research facilities that need to be built, there are classrooms and textbooks and all kinds of things that have to come into play, then you really don't understand education.
But we are so far beyond that at this point, Gareth.
Yes.
Because the decision was taken by politicians that this is
right.
What needs to happen. The headache now lies with University South Africa, with all the university institutions, with the Department of Higher Education. These are the people who now have to come together and have to find a way to make this work.
Yeah.
I would hate to be any of these people, actually, because if this thing fails miserably, they're the ones that are going to be blamed, the politicians.
It's going to fail. We've had basic and secondary level education run by government, and they've tried to make basic education free and available to all South Africans. How well has that worked out? When we have 30-odd% of the people who started in grade one finishing matric. How's that working for us? Now we're going to do that to tertiary education, the one place that education still works in South Africa, and we think the story is going to end happily? I'm sorry. Call me cynical. I don't see it working. Politicians are the best way to ruin anything that works and to screw up anything that could work and to take things that aren't working and make them even worse.
So if you were the CEO of University South Africa, now you've got this thing that's been dumped in your lap and you are told, make it work, Gareth. Yeah. What are you going to do? You can't go back to the president and say, listen, this is a bad idea. I can't make it work.
I'd say, I'm sorry, there is no way to make this work. You've got your head up your ass. You're going to ruin the lives of many talented and intelligent young people. This is not going to happen. I fire me if you want to, but I can't make your stupid plan into reality. That's what you should do. It's the only acceptable route to take. And then go to the students who are trying to enroll at universities across the country and think that free education is already a reality and that all they need to do is line up in the heat outside UJ and say to them, listen, you've been lied to by politicians. You can be cross with me. You can be cross with the universities. You can be cross with your parents. But in the end, the only people who've lied to you are the politicians. Be cross with them. I'm afraid you're not going to be studying this year. And if you do end up studying this year, it's going to be a waste of your time.
So then by your rationale then, everyone who is tasked with implementing this and making this work should rather resign. Well, in which case, we're left with no people left to do the job. And then what?
It's not going to. There is no way to make this work. You can't put a square peg in a round hole. It's not going to happen. And sometimes, in the art of the possible, as Thabo Mbeki called politics, you have to realize that you're making impossible promises. You're misleading people, and you're going to drive everyone down. That's what's happening here. You're going to ruin tertiary education the way that government has ruined primary and secondary education. Which is why so many people in this country are breaking their backs to send their kids to private institutions. Because they know if they don't, their kids are going to be part of that great mass of people who are going through the school system and gaining nothing in the process. It's a very unfortunate situation. And who do we have to thank for it? The politicians.
Politicians.
So why should you be a part of their problem? Why should you be a part of the hideous situation they've created for themselves and for the country? If you have any self-respect, you say, sorry, this is how it's going to be. This is the practical reality. If you don't like it, politicians, fire me. But that's all I can do.
And then the health department has added listeriosis to the list of notifiable diseases. Yes.
What? Remember, you told us about this last year.
I told you about listeriosis. And then a couple of weeks before we wrapped up for the year, I got hit by a stomach bug, which then went to Ben. And then, Gareth, you suffered a little bit.
And we all thought we had listeriosis.
I mean, you know, people love to blow things out of proportion. But the health department is not blowing things out of proportion this time around. Mm-mm. So adding listeriosis to the list of notifiable diseases essentially means that the illness has met the minimum requirements for doctors to be legally compelled to report any cases of the disease to government officials. That's essentially what it means. And now a program has been launched to trace listeriosis among pregnant women. As you know, babies under a month account for close to 40% of those worst affected by the disease. Shame, man. So pregnant women, infants, the elderly, and people with compromised immune systems have been identified as the vulnerable groups. And so a program has been launched by the health department to pay special attention to them. And the department say that they are still working hard to trace the source of this damn thing.
Well, apparently it's 60 to 70% of it is in Gauteng. So
Yes, and the number of deaths from listeriosis also went up. So again, you know, just a reminder for people to wash your hands after using the bathroom, before touching your food. Try minimize contact with the next person.
Right.
Unless they're your child, in which case you're kind of forced to touch them.
Or lover.
I mean, not touch them that way, people. No.
Okay.
No.
Very quickly, I have to check myself.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure nobody thought that. Graham says, the idea that we're locked into this free education because Zuma said it's free is ridiculous. Guess what, kids? Zuma is a liar and he's uneducated. So no, you don't get free tertiary education. Deal with it. Yeah, I hear you, Graham, but it's not... You can't be hard on the students. They just want to get ahead, and they know that the only tool that they desperately need to get ahead and to emancipate themselves financially from whatever ugly, shackled situation they may find themselves in is through education. I think it is so ironic that a man who has no respect for education whatsoever and has none of it himself is the one promising everybody will get free degrees. It's ridiculous. It's like someone who sells mud pies telling you about nutrition. You know? It is.
It's quite an apt analogy.
Yeah, the president is like the god of mischief, Loki, says Vince, causing all kinds of shit, announcing there'll be free education. Now he's quiet and he doesn't say anything. Maybe he's laughing his lying ass off. What a shit stirrer from Vince.
Well, he's not the one that has to deal with it, is he? So he doesn't care.
I love the way politicians are suddenly interested in honoring their promises. You know, the outgoing president makes a promise and suddenly everyone's jumping to try and make it happen.
Mm.
And I can't help thinking that this is because the EFF are sitting on the sidelines using this to their advantage.
Okay, so let's get back to that story that I mentioned earlier about how two sources have now spoken to CNN about what they know about Oprah Winfrey and her potential presidential run.
Yes.
According to these two, they're saying that Winfrey is actively thinking about running for president in 2020. Some of Winfrey's confidants have been privately urging her to do so. And one of the sources said that these conversations date back several months, in fact.
She's going to change the theme to run, not run on.
Sorry, Sia is busy sorting out his U.S. citizenship as we speak.
Yo, Cal. Yo, right now.
She wants to run a campaign.
Oh, run, run, run. Run.
The source says, or rather has emphasized, that Winfrey has not made up her mind about running, so it sounds like at this stage it's just a lot of talk happening.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Listen, all people and nations, the Antichrist has come. Oprah Winfrey of the Oprah Winfrey Show and founder of the New Earth Church is the Antichrist. The prophecy has been fulfilled. Please watch this sermon and then run tell everybody that you know. The Antichrist has come. Run, children. And tell everybody that you know, Oprah Winfrey is the Antichrist.
Now, remember I told you about all those analysts who've been unpacking her speech that she delivered at the Golden Globes. The touchstone of her speech was the Me Too movement, but her hopeful message, quote, a new day is on the horizon, could have doubled as a campaign rallying cry, according to some.
Here's one of those analysts.
So as some political strategists have pointed out in the past, her fame and wealth could make her a formidable Democratic Party candidate, but insiders have their doubts too. Would Americans really choose a TV star as a president twice in a row?
I'm really rich. I'll show you that in a second.
Yes, but twice in a row, Trump?
Do you know who had something to say about this? Sean Spicer.
Spicer, shouldn't he shut up?
Exactly.
Shouldn't he be quiet?
He had the audacity to say this about Oprah. He said, she doesn't have the political infrastructure.
Oh, Jesus.
And then he continues to say, and we've seen this before in our history, where people who have tried to pop in, who are not in politics, and have had a difficult time adjusting.
Ooh.
Bitches, please.
Wait, is he throwing shade at his president? I mean, what is he trying to say there?
I think quite obviously. But who are you trying to say that Oprah doesn't have political infrastructure? That's the truth. But look
who's
sitting in the Oval Office right now. So, Sean. Okay.
Oh, dear. Oh, dear.
Well, the internet is obviously jumping on this, but they're also saying that Tom Hanks should be her vice president.
Oh,
yes. It was
okay.
From the host, Seth Meyers, who did this.
Everybody's going to calm down.
People really got behind what Seth Meyers was saying.
Yeah, so Seth did this little skit in the beginning of the monologue saying that a few years ago he was speaking at the White House Correspondents' Dinner and he made a joke about Donald Trump. And he said, no, Trump will never do it. He'll never be in the Oval Office. And then Trump is now president. So he didn't like a PSA, I need to apologize to the public thing and say if my words were what landed Trump in the Oval Office, then Oprah, you'll never be president. And Tom Hanks, where's Tom Hanks? Tom Hanks, you'll never be the vice president as well.
Lesbianism about to take over our community. I'm talking about young girls.
You know what?
Wow.
They must all run. Oprah must run. Mark Zuckerberg must run. The Rock must run. All of them must run for president.
Kanye West must run.
All of them. Fun times.
Someone sent a picture of Stedman to me. He's got his mouth open. He's looking really confused. It says, when you realize you're going to be the first lady in 2020. Yep.
That's the only expression Stedman has.
What's wrong with you?
He was actually one of the people who spoke.
You niggas are crazy.
Listen, technically, Stedman would be the second lady. The first lady is obviously Gail. Come on now.
Aye, guys.
Gail is
very controversial.
No, guys. Gail is above Stedman in terms of
people
important to Oprah Winfrey.
Yeah,
like, come on.
Yes, Gail got the jobs. I mean,
Gail is more important than
what
Stedman.
What does Stedman do?
I'm
help her carry the baskets with the vegetables?
Gail was actually mentioned first in the speech as well on Sunday night.
That's
but
all I
Stedman
need.
Was one of the people
Stedman
who spoke
didn't get
to
a
the
thank.
Press.
Did he get a thank you?
He did.
Oh,
they, after
she,
Stedman.
She
after
mentioned
Gail.
Him?
Yes.
Oh, okay, well, that's nice.
But Stedman spoke to the LA Times and he said on Oprah possibly running, it's up to the people, but she would absolutely
love
do
you.
It.
Well, sorry, what was that, Stedman?
I still love you.
Yeah, all right, okay. All right.
We don't know. But it's working in her favor. Stock shares for Weight Watchers, and she owns 10% of the company, went up after the speech. So that's... Oprah is laughing all the way to the bank and possibly
usual.
The White House.
As usual.
Yeah.
The bank
run on. Open your ears and close your eyes, and you will have a big surprise.
The bank is where it matters most for these people anyway. The
sure,
bank.
Of course. All right.
Okay. Enough politics.
Yeah.
Would any of you like to sign up for a penis whitening session?
Penis whitening?
What?
Penis whitening or widening?
Widening or
sorry,
whitening?
What did you say? What have I signed up for?
Penis whitening. It's a fad, and it's apparently driving social media insane.
Wake up, white people.
Why would you want a white penis if you haven't got a white penis?
It is a procedure which
penis
uses
whitening.
Laser whitening to bleach the penis.
Oh,
bye.
I know what this is. It's because there's some people who've got these dark penises and the rest of them is light. Now, we're talking about white people.
No, I agree with you. Our penises are generally darker.
Yeah.
No one knows why or why is it important, but why would you want that?
Because, Ben, if porn stars can bleach their bum holes, why can't men whiten their penises? I mean, really. Yes. Why are you being so narrow-minded about this?
I think it's got to do with the fact that you've got flaccid skin and then become stretched. Because if you take your arm, for instance, white people who have a tan because it's summer, scrunch your skin down a bit, it gets darker. Pull it out.
That's true.
So I think that's just because...
Right.
All it took was 2 days, folks. This is the second day with the full official team and we're already... penis talking.
Well, I mean, you know me. So it has been getting a lot of coverage on a Thai television show.
Well, there we go.
As well as social media.
The Thais are obsessed with bleaching themselves white whenever they can.
They are, Ben. A Bangkok clinic that has drawn 100 men a month to its penis whitening service has caused a stir in Thailand. Social media users are baffled and alarmed by the phallic fad. It gets done at the Lilax Hospital. And it is renowned for its body whitening expertise in a country obsessed with skin color.
Obsessed. They are so obsessed. If it wasn't for tourists, nobody would go to the beach in Thailand. Like, nobody.
They don't like getting any sun at all. Huh?
Yeah. So the clinic was saying that they get around 100 clients a month, 3 to 4 clients per day. The procedure, which uses laser whitening, got wide play on Thai television as well as social media after the hospital released images of a man undergoing the treatment coupled with before and after pictures. So penis whitening is now a thing, guys. It's a thing in Thailand, at least.
I thought we were all trying to get blacker penises.
No. What? I
mean, yeah, that would be odd.
Girl, I'm trying to get those small black penises.
Yeah, well, imagine having being white with a small black penis. That would just be silly.
Well, isn't this a turnaround for the bus? Finally, someone wants to be whiter. That hasn't happened for a long time.
But I'm saying, porn stars have been bleaching their buttholes, guys. Yeah, why can't men bleach their parts as
all
well?
All our business area bits are all darker. That's
what,
just how it goes.
Just feel like you have
maybe
an STD.
And the people in Thailand are sick of it, Ben.
They are. They are so sick of dark pigments of Thailand.
Mm. Well, they're taking a stand. Good for them. All right. In the next little while, we're going to meet Nick Wolpe, who I bumped into at the airport last year. We've been talking about getting together and talking about it and talking about it and talking about it. And finally, I'm able to speak to him as the CEO of Lily's Leaf. He's going to pop in. We want to talk about the future of the ANC, what kind of battle of ideas they should be having now that Cyril Ramaphosa is the president. They've got a new leadership. And I thought Nick had some interesting insights when we spoke all those months ago. And he's a fascinating guy. Plus, we could talk about Lily's Leaf, which I know for many South Africans is a place of massive significance. I think for all of us, considering the history that our country has and the history, the role in that history that Lily's Leaf has played, I think it's probably well worthwhile and long overdue that we catch up with Nick. He's coming in to talk to us next. Also run a little later on about cryptocurrencies. And we'll think about a couple of other things when we get to Jay Something and Something's Cooking, his brand new book, just after 8. Hearing a lot of this song. It's Heavy K with Busi and Nokwazi, and it's called Inde. Very nice. Happy song for Tuesday morning. All right, I mentioned just a moment ago that I actually keep bumping into Nick Wolpe. He's the CEO of Lily's Leaf, and we started talking, as I always do when I bump into someone who has interesting insights and perspectives and points of view and contacts within the broader political landscape. I always start talking to them about politics and trying to mine information and find out what they might be theorizing themselves about what's going on within the ANC in this case. And Nick is also running the excellent, and I can't say this enough, the excellent museum that's worth every South African's day, afternoon, morning, whatever it is that you can dedicate to doing this. A lot of people still off at the moment before the schools go back. Lily's Leaf is here in Rivonia. It is, of course, a key historical landmark in South Africa. It's the place that many of the Rivonia trialists were arrested at. It's also the place where Nelson Mandela buried his gun that was given to him by Haile Selassie. It's a fascinating place. It's still there. It's intact. It's worth going to see. And it's quite a beautiful story for those people who can tell it much better and more eruditely than I just have. So, Nick, it's a pleasure to see you, man. Thanks for coming in. I'm sorry it's taken so long.
It's an absolute pleasure, and thanks for having me on your show.
Sure. I mean, we spoke about this, 8 months ago?
More. I mean, we've been chatting on and off for years.
Well, it's nice to see you. How's Lily's Leaf?
It's good. I mean, you've made some very interesting points. I think, you know, there is a historical context to Lily's Leaf, which you've articulated. But beyond that, there is a critical here and now context, which has a historical root. We, you know, our media for the last 2 years and even longer has been about, and you've been talking about it as well, about the state of the ANC, about where are the ideals of this liberation movement that so captured the imagination, not only of South Africans, but the world.
Mm-hmm.
Because Lily Sleaf is focusing at the moment on international solidarity and listening to the stories of people from Sweden, Norway, about how the struggle resonated so strongly and powerfully in them. I mean, there is even an interview with Lindiwe, who talks about the way...
Lindiwe Zulu or Lindiwe Sisulu?
No, not Lindiwe.
Who are we talking about?
Lindiwe Mazabuka.
Oh, from the DA.
No, no, not Lindiwe. No, sorry, not Lindiwe. Oh, God, my mind's going completely blank at the moment. Now the name... one of the struggle veterans. Suddenly my mind's gone completely blank. But she says the way the Swedes are behaving, it's almost as if they themselves have been persecuted.
Let's just be clear about this, because for a lot of people, you know, the international participation in the struggle wasn't as clear and obvious during that time. The Swedes were very involved in financing and the anti-apartheid struggle from outside. There were people who got actively involved, that gave shelter and places in exile for ANC leaders.
Well, I mean, the point I'm trying to make here is this comment about how they, the remark about how they were behaving as if they themselves, which I think is a very pertinent and a very interesting comment, because it highlights how the struggle resonated with so many people, the ideals under which the struggle was being fought, the principles, those valiant principles which are articulated in the Freedom Charter about a non-racial society where South Africa belongs to all who live in it. And then the clauses, which we mustn't forget, which themselves today are still being debated as whether they're socialist, neoliberal, communist. I think the important thing is these ideals were articulated and presented by the people. I often say that of all the documents, I mean, if we've identified all the human rights documents that have arisen from the Cyrus Cylinder, which was the first attempt to articulate the notion of human rights all the way through. So you've got the Cyrus Cylinder, you've got the Magna
Declaration
Carta,
of Independence in America,
and then the rights of people in France. And if you look at it, I've often said this: the Freedom Charter is unique. Because all these other documents were written by what I would like to call intellectuals. The Freedom Charter was written by the people, for the people of South Africa.
Clipton, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
And why am I talking about it? Because of these ideals which Lily Sleaf articulated historically, and which resonated, as I mentioned, around the world, and inspired South Africans, and also was a way of liberating all South Africans, today has been lost. And that's some of the things that you and your other colleagues have been talking about for many years.
I'm interested, and one of the reasons I wanted to get you in here is because there are a lot of people like you, a lot of stalwarts and veterans and people who are heart and soul ANC people, who I've spoken to in the last while, who talk about saving the ANC and how important the last elective conference was and how the ANC is 106 years old yesterday, and that this organization still has so much to give. And the cynical part of me says, and I'd like to have your response to this, and you know, feel free to be as brutal as you would like, either to me or to the ANC. I feel like that time is just up. Their usefulness, their ability to create narratives that are relevant to today is much diluted. I feel like we're dealing with an old people's organization that is applying old ideas and old thinking. And if you looked even at the kinds of conversations and the kind of rhetoric that comes out of the ANC, even now under Cyril Ramaphosa, which some people are hailing as some sort of rebirth for the organization, it feels to me like this is an old and irrelevant business that we would be better rid of now. And just say goodbye to it. Normally when someone turns 100, you kind of realize that they're reaching their nadir.
Look, you've made some very valid points, and it has been a debate amongst a lot of people. Is the ANC relevant? Is a liberation movement relevant? Can a liberation movement make the transition from liberation movement to political party? This has been the million-dollar question and the million-dollar debate. How do you move away from being an organization that is struggling for a particular idea, a particular way of life, and then transform that movement into then a governing party, which the ANC has addressed? But I think one of the interesting things which we need to look at within that context is how the ANC over, I wouldn't say the last 106 years, but over, let's say, the previous 90 years, mm-hmm. was able to use a Marxist terminology, adapt to the epoch that it found itself in. And the idea of freshness was very pertinent to the ANC.
Well, even though Marxism by that stage was close to 200 years old. Yeah.
But
and has been shown all over the world where implemented to have been a demonstrable disaster.
But I'm not using...
No, because you're bringing up the history here. So
but what I'm trying to...
I'm saying now, if you look at the ANC now, and particularly just pre this elective conference, because we still don't know what this elective conference means, right? Just pre that. I'm thinking that for the average South African, we're looking at an organization here that is doing more for themselves, the individuals within the organization, than they ever have for the ordinary man, woman, or child on our dusty streets. And it bothers me, and it probably bothers a lot of other people who are affected far more directly, more, that the ANC is not able to reckon with itself, that we're dealing with people who it's forget about the transition from liberation movement to government. What does the ANC even stand for anymore?
Well, I'd like to just go back to your original question of relevance,
mm-hmm.
and then move on to this other aspect because
it ties
in.
Yeah.
What I was trying to say was that what made the ANC so unique was this battle of ideas that was the spine of the organization. And I grew up in that. My father was a leading intellectual within the ANC. And the notion of debate, of challenge,
mm-hmm.
was so critical. And when I used the Marxist terminology of remaining relevant to the mm-hmm. epoch, was because of the battle of ideas, because mm-hmm. of the ability to create new ideas which were pertinent and relevant to the period that they found themselves in. That intellectualism was encouraged because there was a recognition that intellectualism was a form of renewal, that when you started to challenge and question the ideas that you were holding onto at that particular moment, if you were able to continue to challenge them, you were remaining relevant.
But it's indisputable that intellectual tradition has been decimated.
You're absolutely right. That's been one of the fundamental problems that we found ourselves in today within the context of the ANC.
I mean, you're there. Let's just reflect back to, because we're going to keep bouncing between the now and the then. You've got Lily's Leaf, which represents so much of what was right about the struggle. You had ordinary people in society helping political activists to change a country from within and without, doing things that were dangerous to them, that were dangerous to society, in terms of the state of emergency and the kind of controls that the old apartheid government was trying to implement, and that very successfully in some places they did, and to the detriment of the people in those places. And then you look at what they've got now in terms of who's leading the thought, the battle of ideas within the ANC. It's paltry.
Well, I think you made the point the intellectualism has been decimated within the ANC, and that has been one of the fundamental problems. Because, again, if you look at going back to the 60s, and let's not talk about Lily's Leaf, but if you talk about the conference of Morogoro, that was a conference of renewal. That was a conference of let's be introspective, let's be critical, let's evaluate where we are, let's take a look at what is currently happening externally, within the struggle in the broader context, and also let us look and see whether we are remaining relevant to the period that we find ourselves in within the context of the struggle.
So are they?
And that is not happening.
Are the ANC relevant now, in your opinion?
Yes, but we have to, let's put it this way. We are relevant, but we need to rediscover the relevance of why we exist. We need to rediscover who we are. It is like someone who started off as an ordinary person and became famous and lost their way. You know, and suddenly were taken up with all the pomp and ceremony of wealth, of fame, and lost who they were in that. And then said, hold on. Everyone around them said, this is not you. You are not this person. You need to now take a step back and reflect on who you were and who you were as a person and rediscover who you were. Because if I can just say, there's an interesting dynamic playing out here. Mm-hmm. You know, in the lead up to the conference, you know, I spoke to a lot of people around what their feelings were. And they were not ANC. I would say a lot of them were traditional DA supporters, if one was to categorize them.
Mm-hmm.
And it was interesting. They all said, we cannot afford to have Dlamini Zuma elected president of the ANC. And it's ironic, because if you think about it, Gareth, the polls showed if she was elected president of the ANC, the probability of the ANC losing the election was actually quite high. Mm-hmm. And you would think that the opposition would be saying, yes, elect her so we can get a new political party or a coalition of political parties to run this country. But it underpinned, I think, a very fundamental recognition that at the moment, regardless of how far we as the ANC have strayed from our historical mission, our historical goal, this country still needs the ANC because it is the glue that holds us together. It is the nexus around which everything comes together. And for a while, we still need it because I think there was a recognition, and there is a recognition, that without the ANC as the core, as the center of power, there is a possibility this country could implode. So for as how bad we have done, for how far we have strayed from those fundamental key ideals. And when Sia contacted me and said, come on the show, I started to read again through the eye of the needle. Yeah. It is such a relevant, pertinent document and it is almost a crystal ball. So you go back to 2001, read this document as if you were in 2001, and then take a time jump back to 2018 and say, my God, how prophetic this document was, how the ANC saw what could possibly happen and articulated it. The question, though, is how did we move from the fact that we recognized that where we are today was a fundamental problem that could arise back then and allow it to happen today? How could we allow ourselves to go from recognizing the state of the ANC that we find today, we wrote about in 2001, but still allowed it to happen, and we still allowed ourselves to drift down that particular path?
Well, I think, isn't that because of individuals within the organization who've led it astray more than a kind of collective? Because there hasn't been much in terms of collective decision-making and policy-making at any principal level. It's mostly been about jockeying for position, and we all get very caught up in this. Is it Nkosazana? Is it Cyril? What role does Ace Magashule play? We make it about the people. And the ANC's charter and its principles remain the same, and they're fairly solid. And you would know if you arrived as an alien today and you read those documents, what kind of an organization you were dealing with, hopefully. Isn't it right to question why people inside have become so important? You know, all through the struggle and even up to the kind of latter part of Thabo Mbeki's administration, ANC people always used to credit the organization. They always made it about the organization. They were careful not to hero worship individuals. Has that disappeared? Has that changed? Has it become about people within the situation rather than the system or the organization itself?
To a large extent, again, I would say you're right. I mean, again, if you go back to the document, they talk about, you know, again, one of the big issues has been the issue of the branches.
Mm.
And the membership, what type of members are we attracting? And in the document, again, they talk about we must protect against individuals joining the ANC and using the ANC as a stepping stone, as using the ANC as a tool to advance their own self-interest.
Yeah, but let's not talk about it like it hasn't happened.
Yes, but it has. But I'm saying, I'm talking about what they talked about in 2001 and what we have witnessed over the last 10 years. I mean, again, if I can talk about Moses Katana, one of our greatest struggle stalwarts. He, the way he talked about the struggle and articulated it, which the ANC mirrored, he talked about there is no place for self-interest within the liberation movement. There is no place for I. I doesn't exist. If you join the liberation movement, you join the ANC.
But is that someone who has high ideals and principles, or is that someone who is terrifically naive about human nature? What is it?
I would say it's a combination of both, but I also say that it's a culture. There was a very strong culture within the ANC about that. I'm not saying that the ANC was lily white, was pure, and that were no problems within the ANC.
Sure.
I mean, there's no such thing as the perfect organization.
I mean, we know that there were quiet purges of certain ideas,
yes,
and even sometimes people.
We made mistakes.
Can I move forward to now? Because this is where I'm interested in particularly the insights. You have a lot of contacts within the leadership of the organization. You speak to a lot of people in the ANC and outside of the ANC who are critical of it. Who will take forward the intellectual battle of ideas now? Are there enough people inside the organization, or have all the clever blacks, as our president pejoratively called them not so long ago, have all of them moved to other pastures? Have some of them moved to the EFF, others to non-political organizations? Where are these intellectuals that will help renew the ANC this time around?
They are still there. Some of them have called it, you know, like, let's say, have kind of merged into the woodwork during this period, because there was also a period of intolerance.
Mm.
That if you were critical, if you stood up to the notion of the battle of ideas, because again, if I can just kind of move back to a historical critique and then come forward. I mean, the idea was that the ANC was a group, was a collective of, not individualism, of a collective of individuals who expressed ideas, but then acknowledged that the collective,
this idea that it could
individuality became, is so you had, so if I can say, you had the notion of individuality within the ANC, that you would challenge each other, but at the end of the day, the majority decision would rule. And we saw that, for example, in 1958 when Robert Sobukwe left the ANC because he did not agree with the position of the ANC on communism
and Pan-Africanism
and on the question of the Freedom Charter.
Sure.
So coming back, they are still there today. They haven't left. They haven't, you know, some have moved across, but they still are there. There is still that tradition. It hasn't disappeared. It has just been usurped by wanton self-interest.
Right.
And that group of wanton self-interest individuals have taken over. There is still a very strong core of ANC cadres who are intellectual. I'm on a discussion group and I see them. They are strong.
Where are you guys? On like WhatsApp?
It's a WhatsApp.
Is this what? Okay, we got to get on there. WhatsApp groups have to become public so we can all join in, you know, because I think it's so important that we encourage this sort of discussion. Let me just throw in for a brief moment. I had a really interesting discussion with someone not so long ago who had a great insight into what's going on politically. They said the ANC is still the place of the richest and deepest and most meaningful political intellectual discourse in South Africa, even though it's been eroded to such a degree by this current administration. Because if you look at the DA, nobody really knows what they stand for at the moment. They're kind of, Musi Maimane embodies this sort of soft, neoliberal, occasionally compassionate conservative. Nobody really knows what he represents. He doesn't even know what he represents. You got the EFF on the other side, who are populist, but don't often have the political wherewithal or the knowledge or the experience that a 106-year-old organization could have to mine the policy thought that needs to go into creating, you know, effective government intervention in society, and not necessarily intervention in a bad way, but perhaps even the stuff that just gets people talking about the things that make a difference, the stuff that makes the country move forward rather than backward. There is no doubt that the ANC still houses the vast majority of minds that want to engage in that stuff. But is it still the organization that does this discussion behind closed doors? Isn't it time for them to start bringing it out into the open?
Look, I think, again, you know, you're touching upon the issues which the ANC are grappling with, about the idea of, as a liberation movement, you did things secretly in behind closed doors. You operated in
clandestine ways.
It was a clandestine movement. Have we moved away from it? To some degree, we haven't, and that's part of the problem. I mean, if I can just throw in the importance of Lilliesleaf again. Nelson, on his last visit in 2005, said what made Lilliesleaf unique was it was a place of intellectual, ideological, strategic, military discourse and engagement. And of course, we homed in on discourse and engagement.
Around that kitchen table, that was exactly what happened.
Yes. Yeah. In those rooms, they debated. Right. They were on the day of the raid, on the 11th of July, 1963, they were debating Operation Mayibuya. Even when we were interviewing people like Ahmed Kathrada, Andrew Mulungeni, Dennis Goldberg, Arthur Goldreich, in 2004-05, they were still debating. They were still arguing over the document. So there is a strong foundation and principle of debate, dialogue, and discussion within the ANC. You can't get rid of it. You can suppress it. You can push it down. But like any good thing, like cream, it will eventually rise to the top. It is unfortunate that we've gone through this period. It is unfortunate we've allowed this wonderful organization to be derailed. But because we've been derailed, it doesn't mean that we can't get ourselves back on the right track, because they still exist. There are still a lot of great intellectuals within the ANC who can make meaningful contribution to reinvigorating the organization, to make it a dynamic, creative organization that it once was. I do not subscribe to the notion that age is a critical factor, because if we just look at Bernie Sanders and Jeremy Corbyn, two gentlemen in their mid-60s and early 70s, how they resonated with the youth.
Donald Trump would call them losers.
Well,
I suspect, yeah. I mean, just to end this, because I love talking to you and we could carry on all morning, even though we don't have time. I suspect you'd make a very bad communist, because you've extolled in the last half hour the virtues of intellectualism and the bourgeoisie, effectively, and individuals.
No, individuality.
Individuals. Could argue individuals on the other side of things have made things worse, which we did cover.
But I think there's, if I can just pick up on that. I mean, I think there is a subtle difference between individuality and individualism. Individualism is about self. Individuality, for me, is about the ability to express.
And to contribute to the collective.
To contribute, but accept at the end of the day that the majority rules. So even if you're in the minority and you lose the battle of ideas, you subscribe to that idea because you are part of a collective that has reached that through debate, dialogue, and engagement. I mean, I remember one day, turning to my father, who was one of the leading intellectuals within the ANC, and I said to him, how do you allow people to challenge you? And he looked at me and said, but that's part of how we grow.
Yeah.
He was a communist, but he believed in the fact that you debated and you discussed and you had that debate around ideas. And at the end of the day, if you could not convince your fellow comrades that this was the idea to pursue and that that idea was accepted, you went with that idea. And I think that is a very, and that is a very strong notion that underpinned the ANC. And it's a notion that Lily's Leaf believes strongly, because Lily's Leaf, we believe, is an articulation of that. And I believe very strongly in it. That
I would love to carry on this conversation, and perhaps we should, but for this morning we'll have to call it at an end.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for popping by, and we will come and visit you at Lily's Leaf shortly. I know that there are people who listen to us who are already very aware of what you're doing over there. And other people who have not yet had the pleasure of visiting. So I hope that they will make an effort to go and see what's going on at Lily's Leaf soon. Thank you so much. Nick Wolpe, he's the CEO of Lily's Leaf. When we come back, Run has got some crypto updates for us. We're going to talk a little bit about the craziness of the last few days with Ripple. We'll talk about what's happened to Bitcoin and Ethereum. We'll talk a little bit about what's going on with the new cryptocurrencies that are making their entry into the market. And a whole lot more. So don't go anywhere. It's all on the way. Alrighty. CliffCentral.com on a Tuesday morning. We're in January. Things have happened. There was a lot of volatility since the last time we spoke to Run, but then that there's always volatility in the crypto market. So here he is. Run Neuner is here. He's the crypto man, Run, on Twitter. You've been tweeting up a storm, man. I don't think you've ever been so busy in December, right? And it wasn't with work like the old work that you used to do before.
I'm saying I've had so much fun that you kind of have to get onto Twitter.
Yeah. I saw you say that it took you 18 years to develop the Creative Council into the business that it was. And to make the money that you had, and it took you 1 year to double that money on cryptocurrencies.
Do you think the guys from SARS are back at work yet? I must say,
you're not cashing out though everywhere, right?
I'm not cashing out at all. I'm actually net buying, to be honest.
Okay. First of all, welcome back, man. How was your holiday? Did you have a holiday?
Not much, but it was great. No, it was great to get away, to be with the family. But I was live and I was trading and I was speaking to people in the States, because the States wasn't actually on holiday except for a few days over Christmas and New Year's. And I think my life is spent speaking to people all around the world about crypto and crypto projects and what's coming up, and they're looking for investments and stuff like that. So that was what my days were like.
So since the last time we spoke, first of all, let's look at that portfolio that we started, just to mark how we're doing on cryptocurrencies. We started talking to you in what, September?
September. We put in $20,000 in September. I think the last time that I came here was in December, and that 20,000 was 220,000. Today the portfolio is on 1089. So
$1.08 million.
Yeah, $1.089 million. That's the December that cryptocurrencies had. So,
but it did hit a slide. After that first week, it suddenly started to drop on all of them.
You know, the thing about
what happened there.
The thing about crypto corrections is because it's a new industry, people are quite nervous, and especially the newbies. The newbies come in and they buy Ripple, for example, and they buy it now at 240, and then gets to 220, and they start to panic, and then they start to panic sell, and they sell, and they sell, and they sell. The thing is that the astute buyers are sitting there waiting. And they buy it back up. So we had a correction yesterday. The correction was 25% from the highs of the day before. Now, if you think about NASDAQ or Dow or the JSE, if the JSE had traded down 25%.
Jesus, people would be running for the hills.
And then I posted on Twitter, a little thing on Twitter. I said, I managed to watch half an episode of Big Bang Theory before the market got back to where it started. And that's the thing about crypto corrections. And I can't work out why it happens. But they go down and sometimes a few minutes later, and sometimes 1 or 2 days later, we're back at all-time highs again. Mm-hmm. And it's been the theme ever since I've got into crypto.
Well, market cap, I mean, how are we looking? Because we kind of dipped down and everyone thought, this is the beginning of the, you know, all those negative naysayers that we've been talking about. They all started predicting, this is the final countdown for all of these cryptocurrencies. And then within the month of December, by the end of it, it had not only got back to its original market cap at the beginning of December, but it even gone up a little.
So let's look at the market cap stats. We started off 2017 on a total market cap of $18 billion. Mm-hmm. We finished off 2017 at a market cap of about $650 or $700 billion. That means that if you just put your money into a market index, which do exist in some places, you would have made 35 times your money. Let me give you some perspective. Bitcoin started the year at $1,000, and it finished the year at about $15,000 or $16,000. So if you would have just held Bitcoin, no buying, no selling, no transactions, you would have made 15 or 16 times your money. Ethereum started the year at $8, finished the year at $700 or $800. That's 100x returns, and all you had to do was just hold Ethereum. I think the biggest winners, and I don't have the stats in front of me, were things like Ripple, because I think Ripple made something like 200 or 300 times your money.
If you'd sold at the right time, if you were still holding on now.
If you're still holding on now, you would have made 200 or 300 times your money.
Right.
Which is a big number. So we saw a couple of interesting things happen, and we're seeing a couple of interesting things happen in the crypto market. If we looked at the beginning or 2017, Bitcoin was the be all and end all. Bitcoin was Bitcoin. And Bitcoin went up 16x last year. Now, if we look at what's going on, the money's flowing out of Bitcoin and flowing out of Ethereum, and it's flowing out into these small companies, which
Why?
Are... Why? It's a very logical thing, and I've been calling it for a while on my Twitter. If you look at the blockchain technology, blockchain is going to disrupt every single industry in the world. And I want to talk to you about one specific industry, the porn industry, because they got spanked with a token. So
always the place to watch first.
Exactly.
Because on the internet, wasn't that the one that set the standard for everything?
Exactly.
Video.
So
pictures.
So if we look at every industry being disrupted by the blockchain, it doesn't make sense that one token, which is Bitcoin, which actually only has one use case, which is a store of value at the moment, because it's not a currency at the moment.
Sure.
So you can't say that one use case of the blockchain will have a 60% dominance of the entire blockchain. It doesn't make sense. It makes more logical sense that people are going to invest in multiple applications of the blockchain. Mm-hmm. And that's what's happening. So people are moving money out of Bitcoin.
And as the blockchain evolves, there are going to be different uses that will come into it, and different currencies will have different uses as a result of that. And some will process faster, some will process slower. So people will choose. It's like choosing the dollar, the rand, or the pound, or anything else.
So let's look at who's winning. So the biggest winners are the exchanges, the cryptocurrency exchanges. Sadly, the cryptocurrency exchanges are now closed for business. The big exchanges around the world are not taking on any new clients. So I bought a token. The token is an exchange. The token was called KuCoin. Uh-huh. And a guy phoned me and he said, look, it's a new exchange and they're giving away X percent of their profits through this token. So they're funding the exchange by giving, they're saying 10% of every trade will go into the token. And it was a brand new exchange and it was a 1 cent token. I said, oh, for 1 cent, I'll just take a few. You know what I mean? You can't go wrong.
Sure.
Today, that 1 cent token, I'm talking to you 1 cent in December. Today, that 1 cent token is trading at $20. Okay? Now, that just shows you the mania of what's going on the exchanges. Today, if you own a cryptocurrency exchange, you are an instant billionaire because there are no big exchanges taking on new clients at the moment. They are too busy. They don't want new clients. Where in the world have you heard of an industry like this?
That's phenomenal.
So those coins are running like crazy. We've had a KU coin, we've had the Binance coin, all these coins that give away a percentage of the trading fees of the exchange. Mm-hmm. Those coins have had a hell of a run. The other coins that are running are the second and third generation blockchains, or so what they're called. So there was one called Cardano. The symbol on CoinMarketCap is ADA. Again, we bought that one in October for 2.5 cents, and I think it's trading at just under a dollar today. So that's another one of those great returns.
What is happening with the big names, though? What's happening with Bitcoin? What's happening with Ethereum? Do you reckon that there's still value to be taken for people who are entering these markets now and trying to buy these cryptocurrencies?
Yes, but I think they're going to be slower growth people, because for Bitcoin to grow off a market cap of $250 billion, can you imagine how much money you need to drive the price up? And like I said to you in the beginning of the show, what I think's happening now is the guys are going, look, we missed Bitcoin. We can't.
Right.
It went from zero to $250 billion. But what's next? And there's amazing new technologies that are coming out. And those are the ones that are running at the moment. And like I said to you, I think every industry is now being disrupted by the blockchain. I had a long conversation with the guys from SpankChain last night.
SpankChain?
SpankChain is a token which is designed to disrupt the porn industry.
All right, tell me about this.
So what happens is they've launched a SpankChain token.
Mubs, are you listening?
Yeah. It's called the Spank Chain token is called a staking token. So what you do is you put your token into a certain wallet, and the longer you hold it in the wallet, it generates a new token called a booty token. A booty token is like a US dollar token.
Yeah. Now there's value in that.
Now, if you think about the porn star industry, this is how the porn star industry works. If you are want to post a video, if you're a porn star and you want to post a video, usually the sites take 50% of the revenue that you make on the video through advertising. So these guys have turned the model around using the blockchain, and they said, look, if you want to post a video, we take 5% and you have to pay in booty tokens, which means you have to hold the Spank token in a certain wallet. If you want to watch porn, you have to buy the Spank token and you have to let it ferment in this wallet, for lack of a better word. And then you earn these booty tokens and you tip the ladies, or you pay the ladies or the guys or whatever your taste is with this token. Now, the guys told me they were launching this token.
So in other words, this is decentralizing porn acting.
Correct.
So if Mabali wants to make a movie, and she now doesn't need to have a big production company, she doesn't need to have massive distribution network.
She makes a movie.
Everybody who wants Mabali must pay her in booty tokens.
In booty tokens. Now, I mean, ha ha ha, big joke. This company raised $16 million in their ICO. And I know the guys that did it, and they phoned me at the time, and they said, look, we're doing this thing called Spank Chain. And I thought, I mean, you know, you guys are crazy.
Ridiculous.
These guys are young. These guys are the smartest.
But you took a stake, didn't you?
I didn't, unfortunately. Oh. And today, when I look at the valuation, it's valued at $160 million. The tokens are valued at $160 million. The token has gone up 20x in the last month, 20 times in the last month. It's also been listed this morning in one of the biggest exchanges in the world called Bitfinex. Mm-hmm. So I think, ha ha ha, big laugh, but there's a lot going on. And we're just seeing that every industry is being disrupted.
Are you telling me that if you want to go on as a client for Bitfinex now, you can't?
You can't.
You're not allowed to.
No more accounts. Sorry, we're too full. We cannot accommodate you. Our system cannot accommodate you. If you want to go onto Binance, you cannot get onto Binance.
So are there no exchanges that are still taking people?
There are. They're very small and they're very illiquid. So I think what Binance and Bitfinex and all of the guys have done is they've created, or they're going to create, their own competitors, because all the overflow has to go somewhere.
Sure, of course.
Yeah. So that's the state,
because you can't always get to these new tokens on conventional platforms.
Well, you can't if you can't open an exchange account, you can't get onto the highway.
No,
it's like me asking you to get onto the highway, but the on ramps and off ramps are closed. Right. You cannot get on. You can get out. You can take your money out, but you new money can't come in. So what does this mean? It means that there's a whole lot of money that wants to get into crypto, and can't.
Yes. What's it going to do?
It's going to drive the market capitalization like crazy. We saw the total market.
So won't that then make those accessible currencies like the Ethereums and the Bitcoins and the Ripples and things go up?
Yes, but again, to get up off a $250 billion base, you need a big amount of money. If your token is trading at $150 million...
Run, what about these people who are saying, oh, but Bitcoin is either going to drop down below 10, or those people who are saying it's going to go to $100,000?
If Bitcoin went to $100,000 today, we're talking about 6x returns in a year. Whereas I know in normal stock exchange terms, that's a lot. But in crypto, people aren't looking for 6x returns.
It's not enough.
It's not enough.
Huh.
The guys are making 200x.
So what are you buying?
KuCoin is made 200x returns in the last week.
But I can't get KuCoin if I'm not an exchange.
Well, exactly. So
Jesus,
this is
frustrating.
You can. You're going to just have to find an exchange that's going to accept you, and you're going to have to go into one of the smaller, slower exchanges, which is not as professional. There's a token called Wax Token. Wax Token, we bought them at 7 cents. Now, Wax Token is a very, very, very interesting concept. When people play computer games, they get given a generic look on the computer game. But you can upgrade your look.
And this will allow you to personalize it.
You can personalize it. So if you've got a black gun and you want a pink holster for it, it makes no difference. Just hear me out, Jim.
I'm onto this.
No difference to how you perform in the game.
Sure.
It just makes a difference to how you look in the game. Now, that is a $10 billion market. They call them skins.
Yes.
And it's a $10 billion market.
It's like you used to get those personalized ringtones for your phone.
Exactly. So now, there's a company called OP Skins. And OP Skins is the biggest exchange or company that allows people to trade their skins virtually.
Uh-huh.
And they just moved the operation, or are starting to move the operation onto the blockchain, and they launched a token called the WAX token. Now, why do we need a WAX token? If you think I'm sitting in India and you're sitting in South Africa and I want to buy a skin from you, it means that I have to pay you an Indian rupee, and we have to change the Indian rupee into US dollars, and then we have to change the US dollars into South African rand. And these guys said, no, bullshit. We are now going to create this thing called the WAX token. That WAX token launched at 7.5 cents, more or less. Today, trading at $1.70. We're talking about 1 month into the game. So these are some of my some of the ones that I'm watching at the moment.
We've got exciting news though, because Run is going to start doing a whole lot more right here. And for everybody who is interested in crypto, we're going to get into the bones, we're going to get into the daily updates, we're going to get into the new things that are happening instantly. Because I know for a lot of people, the lag is killing them.
I think what we need to do is we need to do two different things. I think we've got two different types of people in crypto. We've got the guys that don't know anything about crypto. And we need to get those guys to really understand crypto, because what
in a non-insulting way to do an idiot's guide.
Yeah, an idiot's guide. Let's start from the beginning. Let's do a couple of podcasts where we go from zero to getting people to be able to talk about crypto.
Okay.
And then for the guys that are listening out there, which we know that they're trading, we'll try and do a regular. I'm not going to commit to a daily, but we'll try and do a regular update of tokens to watch in the day, why movements are happening. For example, why did Ripple jump from wherever it was, 20 cents to $2.50, and how did it manage and how did it manage to beat Ethereum, and what was a good trader supposed to do at the time? On my Twitter, not that I'm a great trader, but I posted on my Twitter when it got to 325, I said I'm going short, and I opened a big short position on Ripple, and Ripple came down, and I'm still holding the short position now at 240, so I'm smiling all the way to the bank. Now, so I think there's some people that want that kind of information, and there's some people that want just the dummies guy. Just, I don't understand what Bitcoin and blockchain is.
So we're going to offer you both.
We're going to do both.
We're going to start very, very soon. We're going to put together a nice series of very well thought through Bitcoin idiot guide stuff with some more involved information later on. You know, we'll talk to the miners. We'll talk to the cynics. We'll talk to the people who come from a more traditional asset management background and try to find out how they view cryptocurrencies. And we'll have Run bringing all the big names in for us to talk to as well. In the meantime, what we'll also be doing is running these daily, you know, 3 to 5 minute updates, which will give you an idea of what's going on today. And it might not be daily. It might be, you know, twice a week. It might be once a week. It might be three times a week, depending on what's happening. And that's what we're going to start doing ASAP. So I hope you're excited. We are. Thanks, Run.
Awesome. Thanks, guys.
Always feels like we ran out of time, so I'm glad we're doing this. All right, very exciting. So keep an eye on or an ear on what we're doing here at cliffcentral.com with Run, and make sure you watch his show on CNBC. It is the only show of its kind in the world.
Still the world's only cryptocurrency show. It's on Thursday nights at 8:30, and we're starting our first show this week.
I don't know what that noise was. All right, very good. Thank you very much, Run. Very good to see you. Let's get into the unnews for this morning and get to our discussion with Jay Something. I interviewed him about his new book, which is called Something's Cooking, and it's terrific. It's the number one on all the shelves of all the major bookstores in South Africa right now, so we needed to talk to him, and it's always good to catch up with him. He's such a cool guy. Here is what you need to know. Oprah Winfrey's presidential ambitions are starting to gain momentum after a rousing speech at the Golden Globes. Many believe she is the perfect successor to Donald Trump in 2020. Winfrey has tried to play down the matter, but Stedman and Gale are already fighting behind the scenes about who will join her in the White House should this dream become a reality. Betting companies are giving Stedman the edge at the moment based on the rumor that he may still have a penis. A fire broke out at Trump Towers in New York yesterday. Nobody was injured in the blaze. It was brought under control, but certain unspecified items were destroyed. Eric Trump's ivory stockpile apparently went up in smoke, which is ironic now that China has banned trade on these items. And in some sports news, Andy Murray has undergone hip surgery, and though it was successful, he will still be unable to play for 8 weeks. This means he'll be bedridden and looked after by his mother. He would have preferred a team of nurses and physiotherapists looking after him, but he knows deep down 2 months with his mother will make him more motivated to get back to the sanctuary of the tennis court like nothing else. Jay Something popped in just yesterday to talk to me. We spoke about New Year, the holidays, family, cooking, his kid, all the stuff that you may or may not know about him, and a whole lot more.
This is CliffCentral.com.